I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Mick Mounts, the founder of Kiva Systems, a mobile robotics company that automates the warehouse fulfillment process. Kiva robots deliver inventory shelves to stationary human operators who then pick and pack the product and send it off for shipping. Mick started Kiva Systems in 2003, and the company was acquired by Amazon for $775 million in spring 2012. Customers include Diapers.com and Zappos, both owned by Amazon, Saks Fifth Avenue, Staples, Toys R Us, and The Gap, among others. Prior to founding Kiva, Mick worked in high-tech product development at Motorola, Apple, and the online grocery company Webvan. Mick is a graduate of MIT and Harvard Business School. Welcome.
Thank you. It's fun to be here.
I want to start by understanding the traditional warehouse. Could you describe briefly the day in the life of a warehouse worker?
Yeah, the traditional warehousing, at least what I was experiencing in the late 90s, was characterized by a lot of conveyors and forklifts and other static, stationary shelving devices. Classically, a pick worker would grab a tote or a cart or some device and some RF picking device that might be mounted to their wrist, and they would follow the instructions and walk from location to location in the warehouse to find those items. And sometimes they pick an order at a time or multiple orders at a time, but they're going out to gather the inventory, bring it back to somebody else who's then going to do the pack out. And when we started Kiva, we turned that whole equation on its head and said, what if all of the inventory in the warehouse could walk and talk on its own and just come to you, the pick-pack worker?
A typical pick worker can walk 5 to 10 miles a day and spend, 70% of their time walking around the warehouse. I've heard you say before that regarding the experience of a worker, not only is this an unproductive way to fill orders, it's also an unfulfilling way to fill orders.
Yeah, it can be a kind of a rough job, and we're talking about direct labor in the factory setting that's probably being paid on the order of $10, $12, $14 an hour. And it's interesting for a while, but then it becomes pretty routine pretty quickly. Part of the unfulfilling part, at least, is that a lot of the technologies and existing processes don't allow you to do your job well. So you get to a location and you're supposed to get a red t-shirt and you're out of red t-shirts. And so then you end up spending all this extra time looking for where did they put the extra red t-shirts. And when obviously, we tried to change that whole equation with our approach.
With Kiva Systems, instead of the workers going to get the inventory comes to them. Can you describe that process briefly?
Sure. So instead of walking out to a location to get the t-shirts, we send mobile robots that travel on the ground out to get underneath a mobile shelving pod. It's an inventory pod that contains lots of different items. We pick it up just an inch or two off the ground, and then we drive that shelving unit all the way over to where the pick worker is standing. And then they present themselves in a serial fashion in front of the pick worker so that every 6 seconds they can reach out their hand and pick another item of inventory. It allows the pick worker access to every single item of the inventory without moving their feet.
How fast do these robots move around the warehouse? What's the mile per hour?
It's interesting. It's super slow. What we did is model the robots after the speed that humans would be walking, say, for example, in a grocery store, about 3 feet per second. And so when you see a bunch of them in the building, they're all kind of moving at a walking pace, yet they're getting a lot of work done very quickly because the human operator experiences a continuous pick face in front of them.
The warehouses look like a mini city on a grid system. It's like traffic, like cars moving around. How much did maps and the idea of automobile traffic play into your vision of what the warehouses would look like?
The way we approach it is less about like highway traffic and more about just a reservation-based system. So as they drive, they're reserving small stickers in this grid system, and as they get to the next sticker, they release the last sticker. Our software control system is probably more better described as an air traffic control system, which is deciding who gets to go when, where, and why. And then that creates this fluid set of motion amongst all of the robots.
Where does the name Kiva come from?
It is a Hopi Indian word that means meeting place of the ant people, or loosely ant colony. And so we use the term Kiva because our original logo was an ant carrying a package. It was kind of like the ant colony at your picnic that carries off all of your food.
Also, ants are complex organisms who are very strong. I think an ant can carry multiple times its weight.
True. I hadn't thought about the individual ant strength analogy until you pointed it out. But yeah, our robots weigh about 250 pounds and they carry a 1,000-pound payload around of shelving. But the real metaphor that I like is at the systems level, an ant colony is a very robust organism and it's really hard to kill. Mm. Once you get ants in your kitchen, really hard to get rid of them. So we are similar. Our approach to solving this warehouse inventory picking problem is to use hundreds and thousands, if not thousands, of robots in a building, all with a little bit of information, but collectively very capable of getting the work done and very robust.
One of the things that Kiva Systems does is track the popularity of a product. So let's say it's Valentine's Day. There'll be more pink candies being procured or fulfilled than Christmas time. So the robots are able to, the shelves are able to be moved to farther away from the human operators than those products that are more popular.
That's right. One of the side effects of making everything mobile in the warehouse is that you can now dynamically and adaptively tune the layout of the warehouse. And so as more chalky pink candy is being ordered, all of that stuff kind of moves to the front of the warehouse. But the day after Valentine's Day, as nobody's ordering that stuff, it starts to drift to the back of the warehouse and get out of the way. And traditional warehouses would have tackled that problem by bringing a crew of humans in over the weekend to reslot the warehouse and move all that stuff around. And in our system, it just happens automatically.
I'd like to talk about the cost of the robots. A startup kit for these robots is, you know, $1 to $2 million. And if you have a warehouse of, let's say, 1,000 robots, that's, you know, close to $20 million. And it takes you, you know, 6 months to plan and set up the grid system. How did you justify the cost to potential customers in the early days?
There's a pretty well-known kind of trade-off, which we call the two-year CapEx versus OpEx trade-off. I'll gladly spend $1 million if I'm going to save $500,000 a year for the next 2 years. Mm. And if you can hit that two-year CapEx-OpEx trade-off, the automation projects tend to get approved pretty quickly. And in our case, to bring this disruptive solution to market, we had to do a lot of innovation around the business itself. We had to approach our potential clients with a brand new pricing model that took the risk out of the equation for them. So when they were thinking about converting from a conveyor-based system to a Kiva, we knew it would work, but they weren't quite so comfortable. So we'd say, look, if we get all the way to the end and you still don't like it, you can send it back.
You mentioned disruption. Kiva is a disruptive technology. It's not just a bunch of robots delivering products in a traditional warehouse. You really have changed the paradigm of the warehouse. What other companies do you look to who have been equally disruptive in their own industries?
There's a lot. Along the way, we used to think about who else has dealt with similar disruptive challenges when they grew their business. And companies like Southwest Airlines would come to mind. People always laugh about low-cost Southwest Airlines, but yet it's the only profitable airline over an extended 10 to 15-year period. And how do they do that? Well, they just take a very robust and simple approach. They use one aircraft, a 737, for all their flights. They originally had an open seating policy, so people really would hustle to get in and get their seats. And they took a very fun approach to flying, too. Another one we always used to talk about was FedEx. Today, you think about the ability to overnight a package from almost anywhere in the world next day. And that capability didn't exist, you know, 20 or I guess it was about 30 years ago.
Yeah.
It was unheard of.
We were talking about convincing customers to adopt Kiva, and your first customer was Staples. How did that happen?
The introduction, so we identified Staples as a likely consumer of the Kiva solution, and we had emailed into just about everybody we knew from every angle over there without much success. But when we were out seeking venture funding, the team at Bain Capital actually was able to introduce us to Staples.
Bain Capital was your investor, but they weren't among the early investors whom you approached. You got about 100 no's before you finally met them. What was the appetite among venture capitalists when you were presenting this idea?
The first few years would have been 2002 and 2003. I was still living in Palo Alto in the Bay Area. And so naturally, I was traveling Sand Hill Road, meeting with a lot of venture teams out there. And, it wasn't a great time for raising money. They were still licking their wounds from the dot-com crash of 2001. And we were a hardware play. And so at this point, they were looking for the next software company or some internet-type play that could grow quickly on unlimited amount of capital. And so, yes, to your point, we had the door closed in our face quite a bit. And they used to say things like, you're going to need $100 million to get this thing to cash flow break even, and then some. So I became convinced, actually, in those early years that maybe venture capital was not the right funding model for Kiva, this capital-intensive business. So I end up working my network, friends of friends, to find some investors that got it and that wanted to take a risk. I managed to meet up with a gentleman named Sam Kinney, who was one of the co-founders of Free Markets, which was a 1999 very successful internet startup. Anyway, I met up with him. He introduced me to additional co-founders and early employees of Free Markets, and we started to put together kind of a $1.6 million Series A round to get the company to do a proof of concept.
How firm was your conviction that you thought this was viable and this would work, especially in the face of multiple no's?
I knew that it could work, but, you know, as a first-time entrepreneur, CEO, all that stuff, I probably didn't appreciate all of the challenges that were going to be involved in building the company. But you have that kind of that naivete that actually makes you think you can do it, which is useful, very useful, actually.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Mick Mounts, founder of Kiva Systems. We'll hear more from Mick Mounts coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Mick Mounts, the founder of Kiva Systems, a mobile robotics company that automates the warehouse fulfillment process. Kiva robots deliver inventory shelves to stationary human operators who then pick and pack the product and send it off for shipping. Mick started Kiva Systems in 2003, and the company was acquired by Amazon for $775 million in spring 2012. Customers include Diapers.com and Zappos, both owned by Amazon, Saks Fifth Avenue, Staples, Toys R Us, and The Gap, among others. So I want to talk some more about the early days of the company. You were sleeping on friends' couches, and what was your burn rate personally?
Burn rate on me physically, or burn rate cash-wise, the checkbook, all of that?
You tell me.
So the reason I was sleeping on people's couches is because I was keeping the burn rate near zero. I remember in that year, I think it was in 2003, something like 300 days on the road that year, 299 on other people's beds or couches, and one night in a Red Roof Inn because I just couldn't drive any further and had to pull over. And it said $29.99 for the night.
What was your social life at the time with such a nomadic existence?
I was single, dating at the time, so I didn't have a lot that tied me down or restricted me from kind of taking this leap with both feet.
We talked before about Staples being your first customer. How important was that in being a catalyst for other retailers to come on board?
Yeah, so Staples is a very interesting story. We had identified a list of about 25 customers that we just thought, if all of these customers are using Kiva, then we've arrived. And Staples was on that list. And we were pleasantly surprised at the conversation when they came by, only kind of in the ensuing year did we put together the reasons why they acted so quickly. But they were in a hyper-competitive space, just office supplies, and it was them against Office Depot, against Office Max, against Corporate Express. All of these guys are effectively selling the same 3M yellow Post-it notes and red pens. And so how do you differentiate in that environment? Well, it's through your pick, pack, and ship fulfillment capability. And so Staples saw our stuff and thought, geez, if this works, we probably ought to know about it. And wouldn't it be great if Office Depot didn't know about it? And so in that competitive context, they moved very quickly to try it. And then we quickly followed with Walgreens, later with Zappos and Gap and some others. And I think there was a critical mass building. You could see some of the leading online retailers using our stuff. And so that became kind of a self-fulfilling thing where most people who wanted to solve this problem would come and talk to us because we had a lot of the key accounts.
There were other people who started Kiva with you, including Pete Warman and Raffaello D'Andrea. How do you know them?
So Pete Warman is my roommate from MIT. He was teaching computer science and as it related to e-commerce, and he knew exactly how to make this thing work from a software standpoint. And I met Raf through another friend of ours, Marilyn Vandermeulen, who was sitting across the hall from him at Cornell as a professor. I showed him what we wanted to do with these robots, and this built on everything that he had been doing in his academic career with controlling complex systems. He's a controls expert that can make these systems operate robustly.
One example of a robot that he built is a soccer robot.
That's right. You'd put five autonomous robots on a little mini soccer field against some other university, and the 10 robots would go at it autonomously. And his RoboCup teams at Cornell were winning every year. And when I showed Raf what we were working on, it was almost like falling off a log compared to playing soccer. We had a controlled environment. We could put down a grid. Nobody can go in there. There's no opponent that you have to outguess. You just have to control these things. So he signed up pretty quickly.
You mentioned that one of your co-founders was your roommate at MIT. You've had a couple of other friends join the company and also family members. Your father worked at the company. What was his role?
That's right. So I would talk to my dad about every other weekend, and I could tell he was getting more and more interested and getting kind of sucked into the process. And one day I just said, hey, why don't you just stop what you're doing and just move out. He was in Phoenix at the time. Move out to Boston and work on this. It'd be much more fun. You can do it full time. I don't have to call you every Sunday. So he took me up on it and came out, worked in our supply chain group using his logistics background.
You have one sister who's a helicopter pilot for the military, but you have another, your older sister has joined Kiva.
She was a part-time assistant in our HR team for a number of years. And my brother-in-law, her husband, had a PhD in robot path planning. Go figure. So he and my sister Cindy and family moved from the Chicago area to Boston. She was the sole person in our HR department almost up until like employee number 100, all part-time.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Mick Mounts, founder of Kiva Systems, a mobile robotics fulfillment company. Customers include Crate & Barrel, Timberland, The Gap, and Staples. Kiva Systems was acquired by Amazon in spring 2012 for $775 million. Incidentally, in 2008, you were watching the Beijing Olympics, and you've mentioned that the opening ceremony was in some way a parallel to what you were doing at Kiva. How is that?
Right. So in 2008, my wife and I are watching the Beijing opening ceremonies on TV, and they show 2,000 people on the stadium floor making art. And I said to my wife, hey, that was the idea for Kiva. Just put lots and lots of people on the warehouse floor, and they can do some very interesting collaborative things. Of course, we didn't end up using people. We used robots to do it. But I was fascinated by the opening ceremonies there because they were able to make some incredible artwork, and I was told it was all done without computers, but just peer-to-peer with them working it out amongst themselves and coordinating.
I want to go back to when you hatched the idea for Kiva. You had been working at Webvan, which is the online grocery delivery company that raised hundreds of millions of dollars of venture capital and went bankrupt. perhaps because they were too early for their time and they didn't have this logistics framework baked into it. Could you describe how you came up with the idea briefly?
Sure. I mean, my experience at WebN was the genesis. That's where I was able to experience at least the problem firsthand. That company was taking online grocery orders, much like a Peapod or in New York City, a Fresh Direct. And what would happen is the cost of fulfilling the order, delivering the order, and having the customer support relationship, those total costs would completely overwhelm the margin on that grocery order. And so clearly, part of the reason the company went out of business was it was losing money on every order. And my job at WebN was to think about next generation fulfillment solutions. The internet was new, e-commerce was new. There hadn't been much kind of clean thinking around what does it mean to get one green t-shirt, one toothpaste, one can of soup in a tote, a box, or a bag. So this notion of each-based picking, I felt, was unsolved. And I racked my brain for a year over there trying to think about how to do this. The existing solutions just didn't stack up. And about a year and a half later, it was still bugging me. And that's how that's when I really got started on the problem.
We talked about WebVan's influence on Kiva's development, but you also worked at Apple starting in 1996. You were at Apple for about 3 years, and you were helping to move technology onto their desktop platform. This is also when Steve Jobs returned to Apple. Similar to Apple, at Kiva, you really control every step of the product chain, of the design, the aesthetic, the software, the robot operators, the stickers, everything from cradle to grave. And that's somewhat reflective of what Apple did. Can you explain that?
For sure.
That linkage?
That's right. So we're bringing a very complex solution to market, and we're going to put this in a customer's warehouse. So it just has to work. And so we decided to take the same approach that Apple did when they would develop a technology like the original iPod, for example. The reason it was, in some sense, so successful is Apple not only made the iPod, but they were involved in the USB interface to the Mac. They made the logic board for the Mac. They made the operating system that ran on the logic board, and they made the iTunes software that connected to the iPod. So rather than having to think through and deal with all those technologies, the consumer was able to just listen to music.
What are some of your memories of Steve Jobs? Like, are there any, random stories that come to mind from those days?
You learn a lot through osmosis when you see somebody like that. And I kind of had a front row seat for the turnaround. And when he got back in 97, the company was working on all kinds of different projects. And one of the things I remember was that meeting where he rolled out the new 2x2. We make desktops and portables, and we make consumer and professional. And if you're not in one of those four boxes, you can leave. Everything else is going to be shuttered. And luckily, I was in the desktop professional box. Mm-hmm. And then he said in that same meeting, so which one of these are we have this product, what are we missing? We're missing the consumer desktop. And so he had already developed the thesis and was working on his iMac vision. What I also remember about those days at Apple was everything became even more secret and super secret. And so I would, the guy in the product marketing manager in the office next to me would be working on the iMac and couldn't tell me anything about it, whereas only, a year earlier, we were all working on these projects together and sharing experiences.
How did you feel about that level of secrecy within the same company?
It was different, but it was completely understood that, geez, if your customer knows that the next version of the product is coming out, they're not going to buy the current version. So it was understood why.
Any other anecdotes, impressions of him, or?
Well, when I was working there, I used to tell my friends in the Bay Area, it's very interesting because he's so smart and his, his passion and vision for the industry is really compelling, but I think he succeeds despite himself. And that, with just small changes to the way he treats people or leads, he could be even more effective.
You founded Kiva Systems in 2003 and were acquired by Amazon in 2012. How did that acquisition happen? Did they approach you? Were they a customer of yours? to begin with?
Amazon directly was not a customer of Kiva. In fact, that was the number one question that we would get from other clients or prospective investors was, hey, why isn't Amazon using this? But in our sales efforts, we would make the kind of annual trip out to Seattle to try to convince Amazon that they ought to use a Kiva system in one of their warehouses for pick, pack, and ship. And in 2012, the conversation got more interesting as they said, okay, but if we're going to do that, we'd like to own the whole company.
Did you think that maybe they would try to build it themselves in-house?
That's always a real possibility, but I wasn't too worried about that because we'd been at it for, say, 8 or 9 years at that point.
Yeah.
And we developed a ginormous portfolio of patents, and we've solved a lot of hard problems. So even patents aside, some of the things we figured out how to do are very hard to learn. And so given that technology challenge, we weren't too worried about other people copying it.
At the time Amazon acquired you, you had been fulfilling orders for Diapers.com and Zappos, who were owned by Amazon. So perhaps that helped.
It did help. We think it helped. So for a moment there, we thought about changing our marketing tagline to say, buy a Kiva, get bought by Amazon. Mm. We didn't end up doing that because then, of course, it happened to us.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Mick Mounts, the founder of Kiva Systems, a mobile robotics company that automates the warehouse fulfillment process. I want to talk about your childhood. Where did you grow up?
So I was born in Frankfurt, Germany, in a U.S. Army hospital. My dad was in the military, so we had that classic Army brat upbringing where we were moving every couple of years somewhere new. I think I had 9 different schools by the time I finished high school or 12th grade.
What kind of child were you? What kind of kid were you?
I guess the funniest thing I can think about my childhood was when I was an adult already in my 20s, I took the Myers-Briggs test, and it comes out ENTJ.
What does that mean?
No, ENTP. So ENTJ is this classic leader profile where people who run companies, but I'm not that. I'm ENTP, which the tagline for that personality type was called One Exciting Challenge After Another. And I was showing it to my folks, said, supposedly this is my personality. And they started reading it, and they burst out laughing at the paragraph where it said, as a child, the ENTP, when asked to take out the trash, will spend the next 2 days trying to invent a system for the trash to take out itself rather than just doing the chore. And so they're like, that's you. That's absolutely you.
And along those lines, you tried to create, when you were, 11 years old, an automated process for doing your homework rather than you doing it yourself?
Yeah, my mom later, when I was running Kiva, sent me some old little clippings from the scrapbook kind of stuff that said, it was an essay, what do you want to invent? And I wanted to invent a machine that would do all my homework. And I feel like that was actually what I ended up working on at Apple, was my homework machine, the Mac.
Your parents were in the military. How were they as parents? Were they militaristic or?
Probably quite the opposite. They just gave us a ton of support for whatever it was that we were interested in. So, my father and my mother were role models and influential, inspirational in different ways. So my dad was the kind of hard work ethic, always had to be doing something productive. And then he also taught me sports, right? So he was a college football player at the University of Illinois, and I developed a love of sports by hanging out with him. And then my mother had a scientific curiosity, so she would take me, for example, into the laundry room at age 7 and turn out the lights to say, watch this, and open the dryer drawer and dryer door, and all the clothes would spark as she was pulling them out.
Mm.
And so there was a lot of little memories like that that contributed, I think, to both my competitive nature through playing sports and working hard, and then my scientific curiosity that my mother kind of instilled.
You used to exercise a lot before you started Kiva and having kids.
That's right.
Now you have no time. You did yoga. You played baseball at MIT for 4 years. You ran triathlons.
Yeah, it kind of goes away when you have a startup and you're doing 80 to 100 hours a week. But so I was fortunate in that my early few years at Kiva, with my schedule, I could really get in great shape. And I was in great shape when I started the company. And of course, now with three little ones at home, my priority is to try to get some time with them in the morning and in the evening before they get to bed.
I've been told that you drink a lot of coffee. Just how much are we talking about?
Well, so the coffee, the caffeine is a mental stimulus for me. I actually did an experiment one year where I tried to go a whole year without caffeine and without alcohol. And it turns out I ended up going a year and a half without alcohol. Didn't miss it, didn't need it. But the caffeine, for after 4 months, I could barely complete a sentence. And so I had to start drinking coffee again. So I'll have a couple of cups of coffee in the morning, kind of the perpetual cup, and then switch to maybe one or two Mountain Dews in the afternoon.
Mountain Dew because?
The caffeine.
Mm.
And the sugar, I guess. By then, I need the sugar, too.
And you like Lucky Charms cereal?
Yeah, there was a period there when we were getting the company going that I felt that not only Lucky Charms was a nutritious breakfast, but that it was having some impact on our ability to win new deals.
Mm. Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks. It was a pleasure to be here.
My guest has been Mick Mounts, the co-founder of Kiva. Coming up, we'll meet Orion Hindawi, co-founder of Tanium, a cybersecurity company. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Orion Hindawi, co-founder of Tanium, a cybersecurity company. Tanium ensures internet safety for the U.S. government and Fortune 500 companies by spanning across entire networks and identifying intruders within 15 seconds of their entrance. Clients include Amazon, Target, Best Buy, Visa, and the Department of Defense. Orion started Tanium in 2007 with his father, David. Prior, father and son worked together on their other startup, a software company called BigFix that was sold to IBM in 2010 for $400 million. Welcome.
Thank you.
How does Tanium work?
What we realized when we were working on BigFix was that everybody in our space was doing things the same way. Really, that design is called a hub and spoke in our model, but essentially you've got a central server and it's talking to every computer in the environment and it's trying to gather data. And what we realized was, having worked on that for 10 years, that we'd all reached the end of the rope. And the problem is, when you've got an attacker who's coming at you and they can get your data out in 15 minutes, knowing that that happened 3 days later just isn't that valuable. I went to our chief architect at the time and I asked her, what would we need to do to make our system thousands of times faster? And she essentially told me that we'd have to throw everything away and start over. So that's what we did.
Your system is a peer-to-peer system where you have all these computers next to each other talking to each other. And mm-hmm. so there's sort of like this nervous system mm-hmm. that then reports to the central brain or mm-hmm. hub. Mm-hmm. Could you explain that further?
We call it a ring topology. It's a very different design. And in our environment, every client is talking to one ahead of them and one behind them. So they really only have two peers that they're talking to. That allows us to control it much more effectively. So you can throttle it. You can make sure that nobody's being hit very aggressively with traffic. It also allows us to secure it really effectively.
You were talking before how the old system was broken, this hub and spoke mm-hmm. system. And I think of your competitors, the incumbents like McAfee and Symantec. Mm-hmm. They had these walls that try to prevent hackers from penetrating. And your model is, let's let these intruders in and then let's tackle them. Can you talk to me about the difference there?
Sure. In a perfect world, we wouldn't let anybody in. The problem is the prevention model that McAfee and Symantec and companies like that have promulgated historically was based on the idea that you could prevent an attack because you'd seen it before. Mm-hmm. And the problem in our industry today is that attackers have gotten smarter. And as a result of that, the whole prevention model kind of breaks down. What we've been able to do is create a system that gives you real-time views on change so that when an attacker does come in, before they're able to actually do damage, you often can see that they're in and change the environment so that it's impossible for them to cause that damage.
And once they are in and within, 15 seconds you claim you're able to change the environment, what exactly are you doing? Mm-hmm. How are you changing the environment?
So one of the things that a lot of people don't know is that if you look at the attacks that are succeeding, well over 99% of them are being allowed in because of vulnerabilities everybody knows about. So Microsoft releases these patches every month. A lot of people don't apply them. And so what we've seen is that with our tool, people can actually start doing all the things they knew they were supposed to do, but were really hard with old tools. So just enable all the things, the hygiene, that they've known for a long time they were supposed to do. And as a result of that, it makes it a lot harder for attackers to get in. When they do get in, then you want to do things like quarantine computers, send a computer into a different part of the network so that it's not able to talk to your customer database, as an example. And so you can actually control the behavior of the assets that you have that are compromised. Now, the problem has been historically that when you push the button as an IT operator, in old systems, it would take you days before that change actually hit the machine. And the attacker's already gone by then.
Now, you talk about hygiene, and I actually think of the human body. In a way, you are like the antibodies attacking the antigen that comes in, disembodying it. And, you know, hygiene, like we brush our teeth and, you know, as consumers of technology and at enterprise level or consumer level have to do these things that I know I should do and I don't.
Hygiene is actually a really good analogy, and the human body is a really good analogy, because if your brain had to centrally control every cell and tell it what to do, the whole system wouldn't work. So that distributed computing that we do in our body is exactly the same thing that you'll see in our system.
Sometimes people don't even know that their devices are computers, right? Mm-hmm. Like, what are some of the less obvious devices that could be encroached upon? I mean, we know, okay, PCs, ATMs, but what are some others?
Computers are ATMs and heart rate monitors and CAT scanners and point-of-sale devices and retail shops and cameras and fulfillment centers and all kinds of even door locks that are controlled, you know, using automated systems, really are running Linux and have vulnerabilities, and if they're not patched, they actually are susceptible to attack.
Now, heart rate monitors in hospitals, talk to me about what can go wrong if a hacker touches them.
The heart rate monitor can either misreport or stop working. I think there are a lot of people who have a vested interest in causing damage, and especially given our geopolitical situation, I think we really need to consider the possibility that we will be attacked in more and more destructive ways.
Who are these hackers? I think of people maybe like in their bedrooms in Bulgaria or Eastern Europe. Can you give us some profile of the people?
Sure. And I mean, there are some Eastern European hackers who are amazing. I mean, and I think one of the reasons that you associate there is they've had active programs to train people for a long time. So, you know, really, there are three classes of hackers that we see. There's kind of the run-of-the-mill script kid, basically. Somebody who wants to, you know, just basically have fun or get known. You've got the commercial hackers, so they tend to be criminal organizations. They tend to actually be going after customer data or something that they can sell, healthcare data. And then you've got nation-state-level attackers.
You mentioned before that, you know, with your old company, you were approaching cybersecurity in an antiquated way, and then now this company is innovated. How do you know that you're always staying ahead of what sometimes is a failure of imagination? Mm-hmm. Like, what can people concoct? And
so,
you might not.
No, the answer is we're constantly in a cat-and-mouse game. Mm-hmm. And so we need to spend enough time really understanding the market and bringing in experts into our company who can educate our engineers on the latest problems so that we can give our customers tools to address them. And it really is a never-ending cycle. I mean, we release a new module every quarter, every 3 months.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Orion Hindawi, co-founder of Tanium, an internet security company that helps protect corporations and governments from cyber attacks. Orion started the company with his father, David, in 2007. You knew this problem existed while you were working at Big Fix, which was your predecessor company that your father founded, and he recruited you to join him, and you left Berkeley and never finished college to your mom's chagrin. But Big Fix was sold to IBM. How come you didn't stay with the company through the sale?
So I actually chose to leave 3 years before the sale, and the reason that I left, I think, is the same reason that they sold the company, which is that we'd reached the maximal point we could really improve that technology.
So why would IBM want to buy the company then?
There were a lot, and still are, a lot of important customers who use Big Fix. And so, You know, the reality is they're not innovating substantially and haven't since they bought it. You know, as a technologist, it's really disappointing. From a business standpoint, I think they feel like they made a good decision.
So you and your dad left in frustration. And for, you know, basically 5 years, you kind of worked underground even before you had your first client. Can you talk to me about those days?
David and I actually had some choices to make when we left Big Fix because we sold a lot of our stock as we left. And as a result of that, you know, we lived pretty simple lives. We didn't actually have to go back to work at all. And we both decided that we were going to take a little bit of time off. And I think both within literally weeks of leaving realized that we were super bored. You know, what we realized was we knew things that would allow us to build a system that was just better.
What did those days look like when you were working on this? It was informal.
We had a couple luxuries. So the first one was we knew we didn't have to get a product out the door, and we hadn't taken any money from venture capitalists. So there was no drumbeat that was applied to us. And we also only hired people we'd already worked with. And we gave them the latitude to actually take the time necessary to build something that was built right from the ground up. And, you know, I'll make an analogy. If you look at a lot of products in our space, they look like, you know, it was originally a two-bedroom house, and then they kept on adding bedrooms until the point it's a seven-bedroom house, but the foundation is too small. And we knew that if we built it right from scratch, we'd be able to actually build something that would sustain the test of time. Mm. And so we gave them 5 years, but more importantly, we actually worked with some of our old customers from Big Fix to beta test our product in their environment during that time. When we actually in 2012 went to market, we'd already deployed it on hundreds of thousands of computers.
For free.
Absolutely. And worked with those companies to figure out how we could make it work better. Again, I really appreciate the venture capitalists that we've brought in recently because I think they can really help us at this stage of the company. But the luxury of taking the time necessary to really build something we're proud of as craftsmen rather than as, you know, kind of a rush job, I think is what made Tanium.
And you had a pivot moment in 2014 where you did bring in your first institutional or venture capital. Mm-hmm. You raised money primarily from Andreessen Horowitz. Mm-hmm. What was the catalyst for taking on a significant amount of capital so mm-hmm. quickly?
You know, really, there were two things that we saw. The first was that I'm looking at a market that is not going to continue the way that it is. And the reason that I say that is there are too many companies raising money at too high valuations that really are not producing anything that I can see. And I think that's going to change. I don't think that there's going to be an opportunity to raise money like we have, not just us, but everybody in our industry over the last couple of years. And we now have $300 million in the bank, and that gives me the cushion that I need regardless of what happens to the macroeconomic climate, regardless of what happens to this release or that release, to ensure that I can actually do a great job for my customers. So that's one. The second reason was Andreessen Horowitz has a capability that I've never seen before, which is they have something called the Executive Briefing Center, where they bring in 1,800 customers a year. And they tend to be global 2,000 companies that are really great targets for Tanium. And they bring them in to show them what's new in Silicon Valley and really what they should be paying attention to. And if you look at the customers who've bought Tanium, more than 50% of them actually were touched in that executive briefing center.
And this was even before you took capital from them. They made introductions for you.
That's right.
Speaking of Andreessen Horowitz, I want to talk about your maybe it was your first meeting with them mm-hmm. where you showed them the software mm-hmm. and it was so fast that they assumed it was like a mock-up and they asked, well, how long will it take to build for real? And you said, well, actually, it is live. What was that story?
One of the problems in our industry is that people will show you a mock-up and pretend it's real. And often it's physically impossible to build what they're showing, and they just want to kind of bait people into believing it's real long enough that they can go and figure out something else to do. Tanium, we went to them and showed them a production hospital, and we just walked them through the problems that this hospital had and how they were solving it using Tanium. And so, yes, they didn't believe it. And it was actually funny because I got all the way through the demo before they asked me how long it was going to take to build it. And when I told them it was all real, they actually asked me to walk through a lot of it again because, you know, like now that we actually know it's possible, we really want to see that in nuanced form.
You showed them a hospital in California. Mm-hmm. What are examples of issues that hospital was facing?
Data leakage is one of the things that a lot of people worry about. For example, people using Dropbox or people using LogMeIn. You know, these are products that people think they should be able to use because they make their jobs easier. Maybe they can send something to Dropbox so that they can then use it from home or whatever it is. And if you're a hospital, that's a huge HIPAA violation, right? And so computers aren't built in some ways to allow you to manage this very effectively. And yet, as a hospital, if somebody leaks patient data, you have to disclose it. It can be a very expensive proposition. And so the first thing we showed them was, here's every way to get data out of this hospital, and here's what's happening right now. Here are all the people who are actually using Dropbox or LogMeIn or Box. Here are all the people who are sending data out and what data they're sending.
Stephen Sanofsky was one of the partners in that meeting. He was at Microsoft, and he led Microsoft Windows, and he's on your board now. Was that one of the stipulations of your relationship, that you would take their money and that you wanted Stephen on your board?
It's a very interesting question. So a lot of people in our position would have asked for the biggest name. And so Mark or Ben or somebody that, and what we realized was Stephen actually had extremely deep domain expertise in things we didn't already know. So he really understands the operating system landscape and the partnership landscape. And so we did request that we get Stephen.
Titanium is an element. What is Tanium?
What actually ended up happening was I went to a website to go and look up domain names that were available and went through literally 420 pages of domain names before I found one that I wanted and bought it.
And is it a real word?
Nope. I mean, it's basically a play on the word titanium. You know, I'll tell you this, the overthinking of names is really funny to me because, I mean, we sold a company called Big Fix for $400 million and it doesn't get any worse than that, so.
You have been in business with your father basically since you left college. Did you always have a sense that, yeah, my dad and I are going to work together? Or was it more accidental than that?
So I've had a close relationship with my father my whole life. I'm very, very close to him. I always have been. And I didn't know, even when I started college, that I wanted to go and work with my dad. What I saw, though, was that Big Fix was this nascent company, and it was really struggling to find a mission. And there was a need for a big shakeup. And I realized, A, I knew a lot about this problem, but B, that I was getting really bored at school. And so it was fortuitous, actually. Working with my dad has been probably one of the biggest luxuries in my life.
What is he like?
He is the most honest, disciplined person I know.
Where's your mom in all this?
My mom is furious that I didn't graduate from college and brings that up every day.
Do you think that just to please her, I mean, you only have like physical education left and like one economics class. Why don't you just do it to please her and then move on?
Well, that is a consideration.
A birthday present.
Yes. You know, when Tanium's done in 20 years and we've wrapped that up, maybe I'll go back and get the degree.
Your father is from Iraq. How old was he when he moved to Israel?
So he was 4 years old. He actually had to move before his parents did because of the way that they had an exodus from Iraq. And so he spent almost a year basically in a relocation camp in Israel.
With his siblings or by himself?
Nope, by himself.
Is this in 48?
Yeah. You know, I think a lot of my dad was formed in the process of leaving Iraq, getting to Israel. And really, you know, his family had been well off in Iraq and they started from nothing at that point.
What do you remember about growing up that you think your parents, you know, that they let you do that, you know, others might not let you do? Or is there anything kind of unconventional about the way they raised you?
So the most interesting pictures of me growing up are me sitting at a computer when I'm way too young to sit at a computer. And so when I was two, I had an Apple Lisa sitting in our house that I was allowed to play with, and very few people were allowed to play with those, even adults, because they were really expensive.
Now, an Apple Lisa is one of the first Apple computers, Lisa being, I think, Steve Jobs' daughter's
name.
That's
right.
What might I not know about you?
What might you not know about me? I love playing video games. So for somebody who is entrusted by 50 of the Fortune 100 to manage their security, the fact that I buy almost every good video game and finish it is something you probably wouldn't know and they probably wouldn't assume.
Now, there's a big change in video games from when you were a kid to now. I mean,
oh, yeah.
Whether it's like Super Mario Brothers or Ms. Pac-Man, which is now, which is like a whole other 3D virtual worlds. Which do you prefer?
So I never have nostalgia for the old games. I never play games over more than once. So, I mean, what used to be movies are now video games, you know, and it's interactive and immersive. I mean, human interaction and the way that we're going to entertain ourselves is just completely going to change. And it's beautiful.
Great. I totally disagree with you, but that's fine.
Well, just but imagine maybe it's that just... you could go to every museum in the world. Every museum, you could just push a button and you could be in Paris.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Could be worse.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Orion Hindawi. If you would like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.